So this talk is going to be based on Canto 62 of The Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava. And it's got quite an array of characters in it. So obviously there's Padmasambhava. There's King Trisong Detsen, who's the king of Tibet. There's the Naga king, who's called Shines in Malgro. And there's various kind of secondary Nagas and deities. And there's treasure. There's plenty of treasure, hidden treasures, stupas, a life filter. Yeah. So the Nagas guard over a life filter, which has a part to play in this story. Anything that I've missed out? Oh, yeah. And it sort of ends happily with a wedding or a marriage, at least. So, yeah, there's plenty to sort of get your teeth into here. Yeah, and you might have noticed that actually over the weekend, our very own Cambridge Buddhist Centre Naga has manifested outside in the corridor. So I defy anybody to say that, you know, Padmasambhava's magic isn't real. Just go and have a look for yourselves. So, yeah, I just thought I would say a little bit about where this text comes from. It was written in the 14th... Well, it was produced, or it was discovered, or anyway, it came to light in the 14th century in Tibet. The person who discovered it was somebody called Ugyen Lingpa. And that's about all I know about him. I'd love to find out more, but so far I haven't been able to. But he doesn't claim authorship of this text. He says that he found it and that it's actually written by a woman called Yeshe Sogyal. And she lived in the 7th century, and actually she was she kind of grew up in the court of King Trisong Detsen, and she met Padmasambhava when he came to Tibet, and upon meeting Padmasambhava she decided she wanted to become a nun, so she went for refuge and she became his kind of main kind of disciple and consort while he was in Tibet. And so this text appears to be the biography of the guru written by one of his greatest disciples. So it's quite interesting. It kind of came to light, you know, one of my earlier careers was as a sort of a literary critic. So the literary critic in me says, aha, so this is, you know, a national epic poem written in the 13th century, sort of designed to create or sort of establish the myth of the Tibetan nation and culture and the glory of Tibetan history. Because by the 13th century, Tibet was a very significant sort of power, an imperial power, in fact. The king, Trisong Detsen, in the 6th century, was part of a dynasty which actually established Tibet as a significant sort of empire in the region. And this dynasty founded, established Buddhism as part of that, this is the literary critic talking here, as part of that sort of imperial project, Buddhism was the religion that they chose to sort of civilize the country. But I don't really see it like that, although I'm tempted to, because that's my training. But my experience of it is that it's far more extraordinary than that. And I don't know if I can really explain how it's come into being. But I do know that a Frenchman sort of discovered it in the 19th century in a Tibetan temple. A French sort of explorer, adventurer, found the text in Tibetan, took it back to France and translated it into French. And then that French version was translated into English in the 20th century. So we've got an English version of a French version of a Tibetan terma text. A terma text is a sort of a hidden treasure, if you like, a text that comes to light when its day arrives. So in a way, reading this translation, it's a bit like looking through a dirty windscreen with sunglasses on. The sun is there, the brightness is there, but you've got to sort of kind of look carefully to catch it. And I think I've allowed that to give me a little bit of freedom, you know, to connect at a heart level with the text and interpret it, you know, in my own way. I hope I haven't been irresponsible in that way. My academic colleagues would definitely be raising an eyebrow and tutting when I would say that. So that's a few words about the about where this story comes from. I think another thing that I've noticed recently, because Padmasambhava, Ratnagosha and I are going to be leading the Sangha retreat in October. And Ratnagosha had the idea of doing it on the Jataka tales. These are the ancient tales of the Buddha before he became the Buddha. Very ancient tales, much older than this text. And so I've been reading those. And, of course, what I realise is that the stories contained in this volume are very much inspired by those earlier Jataka tales. So a lot of the symbols and the ideas and the tropes, the way the stories play out, echo these very early Buddhist Jataka tales. And that reminds me of something that Bhante said about what's so precious about Tibetan Buddhism, which is that it kind of absorbed, it kind of streamed Indian Buddhism just in time, actually. So it's kind of, Tibetan Buddhism has kind of preserved some of the earlier Buddhist thought and symbolic ideas, which are sort of subtly different from the other Mahayana Buddhist tradition, which is kind of flavoured more with Chinese Buddhism. So I'm going to tell the story. So the story begins at a particular point. So actually, Padmasambhava's life falls into two sort of main sections. First of all, he grew up in India and trained as a bodhisattva in India. And then when he'd sort of, you know, it was about Kamalanaga sort of stage, just sort of up and running, he was invited to Tibet to help establish Buddhism in Tibet. He did have a great reputation for being a magician and an adept, and for being able to transform negative energies into positive energies. So Tibet had this problem, which was that it was full of demons and uncooperative types who didn't want Buddhism to succeed. So Padmasambhava was called in. And there's a famous incident where Padmasambhava first meets the king and they have a standoff, because the king is determined that Padmasambhava, no matter how extraordinary he might be, Padmasambhava is going to bow down to him because he is the king of Tibet. But Padmasambhava has no intention of bowing to the king and needs to impress upon the king that he is in fact the higher authority. It's an interesting story. I'm not going to tell you that the whole story now, but eventually Padmasambhava does convince the king that it's proper for the king to bow to him rather than the other way around. And our story begins, in a way, with the king sort of apologising to Padmasambhava and saying, you're right, I did not have regard for the object of reverence that you are. I'm sorry that I was so sort of proud. And he asks Padmasambhava, what can I do to make amends? So Padmasambhava says, well, there is something you can do. You can build me 5 stupas made out of precious stones. So the king has 5 stupas made out of precious stones. And Padmasambhava plants in each one of those stupas a hidden treasure. And we can see this as actually the beginning of a major building project in Tibet. And we can also see that this building project involves planting treasures, little hidden seeds, for later generations to find. So these treasures will include things like the Terma texts, these hidden texts that the sort of the current inhabitants of Tibet aren't ready to read and digest. They're not sophisticated enough. They're not ethically disciplined enough to be able to engage with the full blast of the Buddhist teaching. So these texts are sort of hidden in the fabric of the building, and they emerge over time as the community, as the culture develops. So these stupas are built, and subsequently the king invites Padmasambhava to the palace. And when Padmasambhava arrives at the palace, the king insists that the guru sits on the golden throne. And King Trisong Detsen sits at his feet like a disciple facing his teacher. And the king showers Padma with gifts and makes a request of the guru. He says, my people are without virtue. I am lord of the red faces, of the uncouth Tibetans who live in gross misery. How can I make firm the foundations of the Dharma in this benighted land? Well, Padmasambhava is absolutely delighted to hear this speech from the king, because this is the basis upon which the main project can begin. This awareness, if you like, of our unworthiness is the very moment when it all can start to happen. So Padmasambhava says, he is a great lord who holds Tibet, and you are right to call on me for help, because I've already had a lot of experience in subduing demons and uncooperative types. What we need to do, O King, is build a monastery. And not any old monastery. This is going to be a major operation. It will be a place of training, learning, and perhaps most significantly, translation. So the project is to build a monastery, start training people up, get the texts from India, translate them into Tibetan, and there you've got it, a foundation for a strong Buddhist Tibetan culture. And of course, the other thing that's going to happen in the monastery is meditation. Meditation, meditation, and more meditation. So Padmasambhava instructs the king to build the monastery in an area called Lobo. So I am not an expert on ancient Tibetan geography, but it seems clear that this is a range of mountains, or a group of mountains, which have, in the local imagination, the form of a sleeping giantess or a Rakshasi. So I think this is something that the Tibetans do, is that they kind of imagine the geography of the land very symbolically. And they, we all do that in a way, don't we? And so this particular area is perceived of as a sleeping giantess. And Padmasambhava says, our monastery will be built on the heart centre of this giantess's body. It's going to be a 9-storey building. And where the giantess's navel is, there'll be a fabulous stupa. Smaller stupas on her head, and then 108 little stupas on each of her 4 limbs. So, you know, it's a major undertaking. I can see Shubhanaga's thinking, crikey, I'll take a few hours at the computer to plan that. And the landscape of Tibet is tough. It's the roof of the world. We're 5 miles, and in most of Tibet, as I understand it, you're 5 miles above sea level. That is a very difficult environment to be living. I was listening to a talk by Robert Thurman about Tibet, and his theory is that the Tibetan people have evolved from individuals and groups of individuals who've peeled off from the cozier lowland cultures. They couldn't bear the sort of the conventional suburban sort of lifestyle. So they peeled off and went and lived up on this plateau where you have to be tough and strong. So, and they've evolved bigger hearts, bigger lungs, stronger bodies. If you want to go to Tibet, it takes time to acclimatise to living there. You know, if you went there pregnant, you have to go back down to have your baby because you wouldn't survive, in that thin climate. And I think that there's also about the Tibetan landscape, the fact that it's so high and the atmosphere is so thin. Maybe you do sort of hallucinate a bit more, So there are kind of demons and nagas. They just kind of appear in the thin atmosphere. And also an awareness that we're closer to the extraterrestrial. Apparently the landscape is littered with meteorites and sometimes glowing lumps of kind of molten extraterrestrial iron that I imagine they made vajras out of. Yes. let's not get too carried away. Yep, so Padmasambhava urges the king to build this magnificent 9-storey monastery. surrounded by hundreds of stupas. And as I've said, it's a massive, audacious undertaking which is going to result in an extraordinary legacy, because this is where the translation project that Padmasambhava oversees is going to happen. So they're considering this project, and Padmasambhava says, yeah, we are going to need some help. We are going to need some help here. So I will go and parley with the king of the Nagas. He lives in Malgro. He's called Shines in Malgro. And he has in his possession the life filter, which is what we're going to need. So I'm going to go and get that from the Naga King. So now I did entitle this talk Padmasambhava and the Naga King, but that's it. That is about as much as we see of the Naga King in this story. He doesn't actually make a full appearance. But anyway, Padmasambhava does go to meet the Naga King. And just in case you don't know what a Naga is, I could just say that they are underwater creatures. They live in lakes and rivers and the ocean. They are mysterious and powerful. And they are kind of dark and scary on one level, but on another level, they're deeply wise. And they are eager to teach, and they do have a connection with the Dharma. And if you can get them on side, they will protect. Their enemies, by the way, are Garudas, great birds that like to swoop down and pick them up out of the sea. And it's important to sort of understand that in a way, Nagas manifest in all of our sort of lives. Whenever you feel that kind of visceral experience of something like envy or ill will or I don't know what else, what other dark feelings, that you can think of that as being the flick of a Naga's tail. Because that's the kind of energy that inhabits the Naga. So to tame the Naga, to parley with the Naga, is to start to get to grips with these dark energies. The guru came along into Malgro, keeping his promise, shaking the depths, giving solid explanations to the Naga King, and having given treasure and a place of worship for the Nagas, he received the life filter. And at this point, Padmasambhava flies off to a mountain retreat to meditate, leaving our king, Trisong Detsen, alone with the building project. So the king, it has to be said, cuts something of a comic figure in this book generally, and in this canto in particular. Even though by any sort of social, cultural and historical standards, he is a great king, because he's the one who helped establish Buddhism and built the Tibetan Empire. Nevertheless, in this story, he's a bit of an idiot. He fumbles and he stumbles, and he's no good at project management. And whenever I see him, I sort of, in my mind's eye, his crown is kind of just wobbling a bit. He can't get it to sit properly on his head. You know what I mean? That's the kind of king he is. The project is going to take 60,000 workers. And even that isn't enough. They need the support of Nagas and deities. This project is going to take 5 years. And of course, as it progresses, snags arise. So the Nagas are on side. Padmasambhava has sort of persuaded them to support the project, but they aren't bound by an oath. So there is an element of risk. There is an element of risk. And as the project sort of unfolds, there's a couple of Nagas who kind of get a little bit bored and they want to have some fun with these humans. The situation becomes even riskier when the king, without quite realising it, falls prey to a certain kind of unhelpful curiosity about where Padmasambhava is and what he's up to. Surely Padmasambhava should be here on site helping. And he seems to, you know, he seems to have abandoned the king. So you can see that the Naga here, as far as the king is concerned, could be a sort of an abandonment sort of issue going on. So two Nagas decide to disguise themselves as construction workers. You can just see them, can't you? with their hat, construction hat, and their little tufty ears sticking out underneath. And they've got like high-vis jackets and there's a tail coming out the end. They look highly dubious. But they go to visit the king and they say, "Sorry, mate, but the lumber that you've ordered for this particular part of the project, it's not fit for purpose. It doesn't fit the spec. We're going to have to get some more lumber, otherwise the whole project is stalled." "What can I do?" says the king. He completely falls for it. He completely falls for this ruse. What can I do?" So the Naga says to him, "What you've got to do is you've got to go and find Padmasambhava, break his meditation, and that way I'll be able to go and get you the proper lumber that you need." So, you know, the king sort of was looking for an excuse to go and find Padmasambhava anyway, so that's what he does. He goes up to Padmasambhava's solitary retreat, bursts in through the door, and says, what is it? Is this? "I must break your meditation in order to acquire attainment." So he bursts through the door, and perhaps he was expecting to see Padmasambhava meditating. But actually what he sees is a massive great big Garuda fluttering in the air with a serpent in its beak. So obviously Padmasambhava is a very accomplished meditator. And as the king bursts in, he breaks Padmasambhava's concentration. The serpent drops from the beak of the Garuda and escapes, and Padmasambhava appears. Down on the construction site, the Nagas break out into riot. Padmasambhava says to King Trisong Detsen, "Attainment of what?" And the king says, "Lumber." So will the project fail at the last hurdle? The Nagas are running riot. The men are exhausted. It looks like it's just not going to happen. And the king says to Padmasambhava, "What can we do? What can we do?" And I'm very struck, actually, by Padmasambhava's kind of patience at this point. He could have walked away. could have walked away in disgust. But he doesn't. He remains calm and patient. And he has a think about it, and he says, I'm just going to have to create an alliance between you and the Naga king. So he secretes the king and a retinue of ministers in a hidden valley down near the lake Malgro. And Padmasambhava himself sets up camp on the shoreline in a silken tent. Nothing fancy happens at this point. Padmasambhava just camps by the shoreline, meditates, and waits to see what will wash up on the beach. A couple of mornings later, a beautiful woman emerges from the waters and asks Padmasambhava what he wants. I would like an alliance between King Trisong Detsen and the Naga king. So she disappears, and they wait a little bit longer. The king and his retinue do not dare to budge a muscle. They just wait. 2 days later, a serpent is seen stirring up the water of the lake. And sometime later, huge amounts of gold powder washes up ashore. So this is a sign that the Naga king has accepted the request to make an alliance with Padmasambhava. Word spreads, and people all over the land flock to the lake to witness the scene. And among them, there is a beautiful country woman called Pagyangsa. The king decides she will be his wife. He has a number of wives. So he marries Pagyangsa. All of the forces settle down and the monastery is completed. And that's the end of the story. I mean, there's plenty more, obviously, but that's all we're having for today. So we've got a story with Nagas, a wizard-like guru, a king, stupa, jewels, treasures, life filter, gold washed ashore, a serpent in the mouth of a Garuda, a sleeping giantess, and a monastery built upon her heart centre. It's a magical and rich story. And I'm going to avoid interpreting it or giving you my interpretation of the story. You can just sort of reflect on that yourself. I'm sure Jung would have plenty to say about this. But I just would like to say one or two things about about how we relate in a way to the symbols of the story, and I'm very kind of inspired by the introduction to Sangharakshita's book Creative Symbols of Tantric Buddhism. I think the way he talks about symbols in that introduction is very interesting. We could kind of think of this story as like a piece of software. So now you've got the story in your mind. It's there, and it's kind of holding meaning, symbols. Or you could think of it as a slow release medicine. As you reflect on the story, it will start to sort of speak to you and in fact advise you. So in a way, this is how Padmasambhava appears to us through these stories. And this is how he advises us. This is the hidden treasure sort of come to light. I think what Bhante says about symbols is really worth reflecting here. What is a symbol? The very nature of symbols makes it impossible to define them. It is best to let them speak for themselves. And this is the approach we should take to the symbols of the Tantra. But we can at least make one generalization. A symbol is not a sign. It does not stand for something that could be known in another way. The whole point is that you can only get at what the symbol represents or develop any feeling for it through the symbol itself. So I think that the teaching here is to sort of train ourselves to be aware of what symbols kind of speak to us and how they speak to us, and allow ourselves to be guided by that. It's almost like they flirt with you. they have when a symbol is communicating to you, it's as if it's illuminated, isn't it? Or it's energized in some way. It's sort of jumping up and down in the corner of your eye, asking to have your attention. And Bhante talks about that as well. When you see, for example, the lotus as a symbol, you are seeing it as being illuminated by some other higher dimension of reality. This reality is described in some Buddhist texts by the term shunyata, emptiness, which is a synonym for the unfathomable, indefinable mystery of the true nature of things. We cannot come at that mystery except through what is around us every day. As the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras put it, we cannot experience shunyata except through rupa, referring to the objects we can perceive through our senses. A symbol is an object seen or felt or experienced as possessing a higher, heightened significance that cannot be reduced to words or concepts. There is something there other than that form, that colour, or that sound, which is both communicated through that form and inseparable from it. So, I mean, I think of that as Padmasambhava. He's my sadhana practice, and in a way, that's how I connect. So we can engage with these magical stories for pleasure and inspiration, but we can also derive wisdom and even technique through these stories. Padmasambhava, in this story, demonstrates that what we need to do is relax, be patient, persist, be sensitive, be humble, be courageous, and have faith. Whatever life throws at us, we can work with it. So I think I might just finish there. Mm-hmm.